You're listening to On the Couch with Carly. Carly's couch is a safe space to talk. I'm a psychologist, but I'm not your pipe-smoking, tweed-wearing stereotype. Hello and welcome to another episode of On the Couch with Carly. Today, I'd like to talk to you about personal disclosure in therapy, i.e. when we talk about disclosure, we mean when the therapist discloses anything about their personal life. And it's quite an interesting subject. And if you know anything about therapists, you'll know that we are particularly prickly about disclosing personal information. This is obviously different for different therapists. So everybody has their own way of managing this. But we're pretty much taught to keep our personal information and our personal lives separate from the therapy room. So much so that, you know, unlike, you know, if you go to a banker who has their family pictures up on their desk and pictures of their kids, therapists don't usually have pictures of their families in their offices. And we also don't really talk about our private lives when our clients ask us about ourselves or anything that we, you know, anything to do with our private lives. We mostly avoid the subject or speak about it, the meaning of the question, rather than actually giving any information. And the reason for this is, well, I suppose partly because it's really important that when you come to therapy, you feel like you have full access to a person who is, well, really for you, and that they are not coming in to the process with any of their stuff, with any of their needs. So if you know, for example, that this person's not feeling well or they're struggling with their, I don't know, let's just assume you come into therapy and you say to the therapist, oh, how are you? And the therapist says, oh, I've just had such a bad day, you know, it's just been so stressful. Then all of a sudden you're thinking about your therapist and your therapist's needs and your therapist's feelings and the therapy is no longer just for you. So I think the more you know about someone, the more you're going to think about them, the more you're going to be concerned about them, and the more you're going to kind of think of them as a person who has thoughts and feelings and needs, whereas what you're really supposed to do in therapy is think about yourself. So that's how I make sense of it. But I also think, and I know theoretically, that we have to try and keep our stuff out of the therapy room and try and keep our personal lives out, because we really want our clients to not know us and to almost see us as a blank canvas on which to project their interpretations of who we are and what we're about. Because the truth is we use those to make sense of you as the client. So let me give you an example. So if I'm sitting there as the therapist and I ask you about, say, for example, how you're feeling about your exams coming up, and my question stimulates this thought in you that I'm being particularly obsessive about your marks, or I'm questioning your grades, or I'm, you know, and you say to me, why do you always have to be so concerned with my grades? Something like that. Then I can really help to interpret that around that being something that you're doing as the client. You're projecting that onto me. You're putting that onto me. And that's what we call a transference, which is when something about your past or your experience in relationships is being projected onto the therapist, and you have a feeling that I'm doing something in the relationship that I'm probably not doing. It's just something that you've interpreted based on feelings you have about probably someone else who was like that, you know. So possibly either your mom or your dad or someone else in your life was obsessed with marks, and that's why you feel like I am being like that in that moment. And we'll get to that, and then there'll be a process that you can then go through. You can then start to unpack that and make sense of that, make sense of the feelings that are connected to that. So that is the bottom line. Obviously, this extends to, you know, we try and hide our personal lives for the most part from our clients, and that includes social media. So, you know, for the most part, clients shouldn't be able to access our private social media. It's something I had to learn the hard way. You know, that there is a need to keep that stuff private. But obviously that's quite a new problem that has been facing psychologists only in recent times. But it's a gray area because now I have my blog, you know, which has got some personal information on it. And, you know, my clients can access that. It's on the internet. So I just have to be really aware of like what I put out. Same with this podcast, you know, I've got to be really aware of what I'm putting out there, that it's not something that would go beyond what I would say in a therapy room. So yeah, I think that's quite an interesting concept, just to think about. If you aren't aware of that, as someone who isn't aware of, you know, what this profession entails, it's a very fascinating aspect of the work that we kind of keep our private lives very, very hidden from our clients. And there's another element of that, and that is that if we see our clients out in public, we don't acknowledge them. And that's often to protect our clients, because we don't want our clients to have to explain to someone who that person is if they haven't told them they're in therapy. But it's also for that same reason that we try and keep our personal and our professional lives separate. But in saying that, I decided to play with that a little bit today. And so even though I am fully on board with the fact that psychologists should not be disclosing personal information, although I am aware that there are times when that is so unavoidable and you just have to deal with it. So sometimes there's things that just come up. I mean, I went on maternity leave last year and, you know, very obviously I couldn't hide that anymore at some point. So there's things that we really do have to acknowledge are just impossible to hide about who we are. And that's okay. You know, we've got to manage that. We've got to work with that. But when it comes to choosing to disclose personal information, I thought I would sort of walk the line a little bit today in this session. And I decided to go onto the internet and Google questions for psychologists. And what I came up with was this great website called Psych Central, where they ask 10 questions of different psychologists every week. And I thought I would just play along with that and answer these 10 questions. And they are a little bit personal, but not really. They're mostly about the work. But in a way, it's a little bit different from what you would get if you met me in therapy, because in therapy you don't get the opportunity to ask me any questions. You know, I suppose that's not entirely true. People ask me questions all the time. You just might not get an incredibly satisfying answer in the way you would if you were interviewing me for a magazine. So here is a kind of version of an interview that I'm going to offer you. I'm interviewing myself though. So there's 10 questions, okay? The first question is, what's surprised you the most about being a therapist? And my answer to that is that what's surprising about being a therapist, and I suppose I've been doing this now, well, I started my training, you know, 10 years ago, basically. So I suppose what's really surprising for me is how interesting this job still is to me, how intrigued I am by human lives, how fascinated I am by human stories, and how much of a privilege and a pleasure it is to be on a journey with another human being while they discover themselves. I really am stimulated by my work, and I'm stimulated on many levels. I'm stimulated intellectually. I'm stimulated creatively. I feel like my work is creative. I have to find creative solutions. I have to think creatively in terms of looking at a group of problems or a model of a person and try and figure out, you know, what I'm seeing, what am I looking at. Yeah, so it's fascinating. It's fascinating work, and I think that's such a privilege and such a great. Wow, what a great honor to have a job that you feel stimulated by, you know. And I see a lot of people who are often sort of halfway through their careers or only a short way down the line in their careers and feeling a bit demotivated and feeling understimulated and like they're looking for something else, you know. And I'm so lucky that I have that feeling in my work. I mean, obviously it doesn't always feel that way. There's definitely some moments where there's like a feeling, but it's really few and far between, and we always come back to this place of, wow, this is exciting. The other thing I thought about when I saw this question, like what surprises you the most, you know, I suppose it's this idea that people give themselves such a hard time. We don't give ourselves enough credit, I don't think. So much, you know, I see so many people come to me at their lowest points. And what I see in them that they don't see in themselves is so often this incredible resilience, this strength, this power, this you know, this immense resilience that they have, that if they could see it, they would feel they could overcome anything. They would feel that they could really do anything in this world. And it's such a beautiful thing when someone gets it, when someone finds that inner resourcefulness inside of themselves and connects with it and really believes in themselves, you know, that most people have got so much gumption, you know, like they can go out and get what they want. And obviously that's not the case for everyone, but even the people that don't feel that way, we get there in the end. You know, there's something so beautiful about actualizing that and about facilitating that with someone. So yeah, that's always my biggest shock, is how little credit we give ourselves and how people come into therapy seeing the worst of themselves and really ignoring the parts of themselves that that are so capable and so amazing. The second question is, what's the latest and greatest book you've read related to mental health, psychology, or psychotherapy? I have to be honest with you, my books are mostly, you know, I'm not so into reading psychology books that much. When I read for pleasure mostly. But I have really, really loved and gotten into the work of Brené Brown recently. So she is a standout for me in terms of, I guess, a self-help author, although I really dislike that term. But I don't really dislike the term. I just dislike the industry, let's call it that. Get fixed in 10 steps industry, that doesn't appeal to me. But what I love about Brené Brown is she speaks to our common humanity, and she speaks to aspects that we can all resonate with in ourselves. You know, the thing she writes about, you know, that no one would read what she's written and say like, oh, that I cannot relate to this at all. She's really relatable, and she writes in a beautiful way as well. And if you haven't ever heard of Brené Brown, let me tell you, watch her TED Talk. She has written she's written a few books, but her TED Talks are really easily accessible. So you can literally just Google them now. The one is on vulnerability and the other one's on shame. And she's a brilliant speaker. She also has a Netflix special. She's also been on Oprah's Super Soul Sunday. She's quite a babe. She's doing the work. But her books are also really great. And I'd say the standout for me was Daring Greatly. And I really refer to that a lot in my work. I also love anything written by Oliver Sacks. He's now passed, but he was a brilliant neurologist and therapist, and has a brilliant sense of humor. And he wrote a really great novel as well. I'm trying to think what it's called now. But one of the books that he's famous for is The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, or something like that. And he writes about neurological disorders and how interesting they are and what they teach us about how the brain works and how our minds work. And then in terms of a more clinical kind of collection of books, anything written by Nancy McWilliams really, really stimulates me, you know, clinically. I think she writes for clinicians. She makes sense of psychological theories in a way that really kind of jumps out of the page. So she really helps me to feel like, oh, this is what it's going to feel like to work with these kinds of personalities in the room. And this is how to think about a human being from start to finish. You know, she does. So the two books I'm referring to is, I think, Clinical Formulation and oh gosh, I can't think what the other one is. But they're very much more like the therapists would read these books. I wouldn't say anyone else would be very interested in reading them. Okay, so that's that question. Number three, what's the biggest myth about therapy? So definitely the myth that you have to, that only really messed up people go to therapy, or really, really kind of disturbed psycho people will go to therapy. Such a problem that that is the myth that I suppose there's still so much taboo around going to therapy, although that's decreasing a lot and I'm loving that. But yeah, there's always been this, I think particularly in conservative cultures, particularly in religious groups, there's a real kind of skepticism around therapy. There's a real feeling that it's a kind of, I don't know, a pseudoscience, or it's not real. It's just talking to someone, paying to speak to someone, or whatever. It's like, why don't you just speak to your friend? You know, that kind of thing. But also the idea, the other thing that I think is a myth of around therapy is this idea that if you go to therapy, then it's a sign of weakness. And that's a huge pity, because honestly, I think it's one of the bravest things you can do is to choose to go to therapy and to encounter yourself, to really face your feelings and your fears and all the things that you are kind of haunted by. You know, you're going and you're saying, okay, this is me. This is what I struggle with. I think that's flipping brave. Like, you know, it takes balls to go and want to face that stuff. And sometimes we are forced to because we're in such a mess in ourselves. But that doesn't mean it's not brave, because you still have to do it. You know, you still have to walk the walk. And that's the thing about therapy. It's not a quick fix. It's not just a walk into my office, have a conversation, you leave better. It's an ongoing work in progress. You have to stick it out. You have to plug away. And that's the part that I think takes such immense courage, to stick it out with yourself day in and day out, week in and week out, you know? So yeah, so the fourth question is, what seems to be the biggest obstacle for clients in therapy? So look, in South Africa, I think number one biggest obstacle is finances. I think private psychologists are flipping expensive, and we're looking at like a medical aid rate of around 900 rand an hour here. So that's what I charge my private clients as well. So, you know, it's a lot of money to put aside every week, to dedicate every month. You really have to be earning well to be able to afford that. And if you can't afford that, it can feel like a huge squeeze to try and find that money. And really hard to make that choice then, to put that money into something like that. So I think that's one of the biggest barriers that keeps people from therapy. I think also once you're in the therapy, self-sabotage is a huge thing. So we tend to get, you know, we confront the stuff. And then I think when you realize that coming to therapy entails looking at your shit and actually dealing with it, and every week you have to look at it again and again and again, I think it can get really hard and people want to run away. And so very often, the choice is made to rather just bail rather than dealing with it. And that's really unfortunate, but it happens a lot. And so although probably consciously you're saying all sorts of other things, like I'm choosing to end therapy because I'm prioritizing this, or I'm focusing on that, or I don't have the time, or it's too much effort or money or whatever it may be, but like underneath the underlying reasons are probably a bit of fear, a bit of resistance, you know, just not really being fully committed. And then I think a big thing that comes with therapy, which doesn't happen with everyone, but there is a certain kind of client who will come to you and say, as a therapist, help me fix this, make this better, solve this problem for me. And it's really easy, I think, to get into the trap of expecting a therapist to do the work for you, or expecting anyone else to do the work for you, you know, like, and wanting a solution, wanting a fix, rather than realizing that the responsibility is always going to be on your shoulders. You have to figure out your way through. You know, it's on you to work through the difficulties and to make different choices for yourself. And I can't do that for you. I can sit with you and think through things with you and make sense of it with you. But at the end of the day, you're living your life. And I think people really, really do come undone at that stage of therapy when it's like, sorry, the ball's in your court now. You've got to you've got to make those changes. And it can come sometimes become quite like a little bit of a loop where we're constantly just talking about why you're not making the changes. You know, what's difficult for you about making the changes, or what's preventing you from it, or what's the barrier? And, you know, that can be, that can be a bit difficult. And so really it's about getting in your own way then, you know, the obstacle is then yourself. Okay, so the fifth question is, what's the most challenging part about being a therapist? So I mentioned in my previous episode about confidentiality and how I can't speak to anyone about my work. And I think that is one of the most challenging aspects of my work, like just not being able to talk about it with other people and having to keep everything to myself. I think it does feel quite lonely and isolated sometimes, like not being able to share on a daily basis with someone. And then, you know, also just dealing with some really intense interactions. So, you know, if people come to therapy and they're really struggling, sometimes people bring a whole lot of stuff into the room that is very intense and very challenging. And particular personalities can be really hard work. So people can be very demanding of therapy and of therapists. And it's hard to think through everything all the time. Like, you know, as a therapist, you can't just switch off. You can't just go into autopilot. Like, you've got to constantly be present and in the moment and thinking and working on you know, understanding the person, understanding what you're feeling, understanding what they're feeling, making sense of it in terms of the history and what they've told you about themselves. So it's a lot going on, and the more intense the experience with the client, the more challenging it is to kind of keep your thinking cap on, in a way, and to keep present and to not resort to, you know, coping mechanisms, really. So it's a lot of work, and it's a lot of taking responsibility for your own feelings and working with yourself in the moment. The other thing I also struggle with is with people who are resistant to being helped, and they are struggling so much, and they come into therapy and they almost just are defeatist, and it's very slow going, where they get in the way of their own progress. And I suppose it's just sad for me and hard for me to witness someone who is not able to take the help, not able to make use of the process that they're in, or make use of anything that's in their lives to assist themselves into a better place. And it happens a lot. So I think the biggest challenge with this work is to not get defeated by witnessing and bearing witness to so much hard stuff, you know, so many traumas and so much suffering. To be witness to that and to sit with that with someone and to hold that space, you know, but to not let it get you down. I think that's quite challenging. Okay, number six is, what do you love about being a therapist? So I love the hours. I love the flexibility. I love the fact that I can dictate my schedule. So I currently only work certain hours of each day, and I've sort of managed my schedule so that I have flexibility and I have time off. And I really love that, especially as a new mom. It's given me the greatest gift of having time with my child. And I don't think everyone gets that. I think a lot of people are forced into jobs where you have to work 8 hours a day, you have to work according to a certain schedule that's prescribed. And I'm lucky I don't have to do that. I can dictate my hours. I can decide exactly when I want to work. And I unfortunately have to stick to those hours. I have to work them every week. But I mean, I think for the most part, I've got an incredible amount of flexibility and balance in my life. And I just love the fact that my job is about connecting with other people and connecting to like a common humanity. I think what a great privilege that's what my job is, you know, that my interest is being with people and understanding them and being with them in the hard times and helping them through it. You know, I think it's beautiful. I really do really appreciate that. And it's really cool to help someone. It's really rewarding, you know, to help someone feel better about themselves, to get them, to facilitate someone who is making progress, or to help someone to take a new direction in life, to help bring people greater awareness, to help them through difficult times. I mean, this is pretty special stuff. So that's hugely rewarding, and you know, keeps me going. It's my fix, right? So I don't know if I believe in altruism. Maybe, but I'm not altruistic. I don't do this job because I'm like, you know, somehow better than anyone else or self-sacrificing or whatever. I do this job because it fulfills me. I do this job because helping people makes me feel good, and that's why I do it. It's beneficial to me. I love it. So that's the bottom line. So number 7 is, what's the best advice you can offer on leading a meaningful life? So yeah, I think to start, you have to be honest with yourself. I really am a very honest person. Some people would say too honest. I don't think that's a thing. I think I'm very clear. I'm very honest. I'm very truthful. I don't have a filter sometimes, in the sense that I say things as I feel them. But I really believe that you have to start by being honest with yourself. So what are you feeling? What's happening with you? Figuring out who you are. And it's such a big part of becoming a better person, and becoming enjoying life and finding meaning in life is knowing yourself. I mean, I think that's what all the most ancient philosophers have said, you know thyself. So therapy really helps with that. The clearer you are of yourself, the clearer you are, the more you understand yourself, the easier it is to be honest. And then to really take responsibility for your life. And I also feel like the other thing about a meaningful life is to be grateful, to look at what we have rather than what we don't have. I really am a proponent of gratitude. I always used to run this thing on my blog called Gratitude Wednesdays, just to remind everyone once a week that there's lots to be grateful for, and that you can probably always at any time write a list about the things you're grateful for, and one should. It really helps the mood. So yes, I really do believe in the power of gratitude. Okay, number 8 is, if you had your schooling and career choice to do all over again, would you choose the same profession, or professional path? And if not, what would you do differently and why? Okay, so yes, I think I would choose the same. I sometimes fantasize about other career paths, but I think they're mostly fantasies. Like, I imagine maybe going into banking and being like super rich and, you know, and like ruthless in business and not caring about anyone. But it's definitely just a fantasy, because I'm actually really happy with what I've got, and I don't need more. And I don't think rich people necessarily are happy. I definitely don't think that's the key to a meaningful life. But yeah, it's not real. I'm happy with my choices. I suppose I could do something more. No, there's really actually nothing I would rather do than this. That's kind of cool. Okay, number nine. If there's one thing you wished your clients or patients knew about treatment or mental illness, what would it be? Okay, so I think people... people feel alone a lot of the time, and they feel like they're the only people that feel these feelings. Like, I'm the only one with this struggle. I'm the only one who has this problem. And it's really hard to get past that. Like, how do you move into a place of starting to share with people that you struggle, starting to share your vulnerability? Most people just hide that from everyone. They think, no, I've just got to be happy and fun and playful, and that's what people like. And if I tell them I'm struggling, they're not going to like me. They're not going to want to hang out with me. I'm going to be Debbie Downer, you know? They end up feeling worse about the fact that they're feeling crap, you know? Then they feel almost guilty or bad or shameful about the fact that they're having these struggles, these difficulties. So that's why I think therapy is so great, is that it's so important to realize that everybody struggles, and I wish everybody knew this. I wish that everybody was told all the time that it's okay to struggle, that that everybody has hard times, that everybody feels these yucky feelings sometimes, and that it's okay, and that those parts of you are not the bad parts, that they can be included in how you see yourself, and that it's okay. So I really think therapy helps that. That whole aspect is that, you know, you do just feel less alone when someone's completely acknowledging your feelings as normal and understandable reactions to your experiences. I suppose I do believe that we have the power to change our lives, and that, you know, there is almost a limitlessness to our human potential, and that includes our transformational abilities. I think... One of the things I really recommend for people to do when they're in therapy is to look at the small steps that you take, you know. So one of the things we do as human beings is we want to go from 1 to 10. We want to see a radical shift. And if we don't see that, then we feel like we're not making ground. We're not getting anywhere. And it's so important to acknowledge 1 to 2, 2 to 3. You know, to go from 1 to 3 is a huge jump in accomplishment. You know, it's a huge change. It's a huge shift. It takes incremental steps to make radical change. But radical change is always possible. Always, always, always possible. And it's so beautiful to see when it does happen, when people look back and they go, oh my word, I'm not where I used to be. Yeah, okay, I'm not where I want to be, but I don't know if we're ever going to be where we want to be. Isn't it fun to still be excited about the journey ahead, to still look forward to things, to still want to achieve things or want to go, you know, further into something? Yeah, like we're never going to arrive there, right? So the most important thing is to acknowledge where you've come from and what you've been able to achieve thus far. Okay, the last question is, what personally do you do to cope with stress in your life? And this is probably the most personal that I'm prepared to go in terms of personal disclosure. So to wrap up this episode, I'm going to give you a little bit of myself and to teach you a little bit of what I do to take care of myself. So I am a huge, huge believer in self-care. I talk about self-care a lot. It's a bit of a buzzword, or it's a bit of a phrase that's like, you know, around at the moment. And it's got a bit of a reputation for being about like going to the nail salon or getting a massage. It's quite bougie. But what I really think is important about self-care is it's about the self. So let's look at that. So I guess I'm telling you a little bit about myself then in this process. So I believe that to take care of oneself and to not get stressed in life, one has to have balance. So you've got to kind of like find the different aspects of yourself, and you've got to stimulate those different aspects. So I really like to in my personality, I have so many different aspects of my personality, but like, on the one hand, I'm really outgoing and I love being social. I'm like quite a social butterfly. So even though this is in stark contrast to my work, which is very cerebral, I'm sitting, I'm quiet, I'm listening, I'm in my head, you know, a lot. That means I need to balance that out with going out and seeing friends and going to events and being stimulated in a social way where I get to be outgoing and extroverted, which is my nature. That's really important for me. I need to feel like I have that outlet. And obviously when I was younger, I was a lot more involved in kind of my social world. And as I've gotten older, I suppose it happens to the best of us, I've just sort of retreated a little bit from the social engagement. But it's still important. So, you know, it may not be happening as often as it used to happen, but it has to happen still. And when it doesn't happen, it feels like I'm not all is not right, you know, like I need that outlet to feel balanced and good and not stressed out. So the other thing I like to do, and I always think is such a healthy and great thing and such a brilliant thing about living in Cape Town, is that I like to go for walks, and particularly walking in nature, anywhere where I can see nature. So in the mountain, in the forest, on the beach, on the promenade, in the park, whatever, you know, We have so much beautiful nature around us. And for me, like if I'm stressed or if I'm thinking about something too much or if I'm just feeling tense or if my shoulders are stiff from sitting down at the desk too long, to just step out and go for a walk and stretch my legs and hear the birds in the trees or hear the waves lapping the shore, like that for me is immediately therapeutic and calming and soothes me and helps me to find my equilibrium again. The other thing I also do, which is a kind of hack that I developed, is that when I'm feeling sad or lonely or like I'm sore or tender inside emotionally, I like to call this giving myself a hug. And what I do is I make popcorn and I make hot chocolate and I put something like a really silly rom-com on, like Notting Hill, and I put it on Netflix and I crawl into bed and I eat my popcorn and drink my hot chocolate and watch Netflix. And even though there might be times when that behavior set looks problematic, like I suppose I could have interpreted it as like lazy, unproductive, you know, we have such amazing ways of being hard on ourselves, but for me it's the way I approach it. So I think about it as if it is me giving myself a hug, me tucking myself into bed and giving myself some love for a little bit of time. And while I'm doing it, I feel nourished, I feel nurtured, I feel taken care of. And so that's my approach. So that's a little hack of mine. So in terms of self-care, my approach is it really doesn't matter what you do for self-care. As long as you are aware that you're doing it for you, it's something that either makes you excited or stimulated. You know, I always use the example of something that makes your heart zing, you know, like those things that just, it's like, ah, this feels so good. Or it's something that soothes you, something that really provides comfort, that it's like, you know, drinking a nice cup of tea and reading a good book, or that's self-care. That's saying, I'm doing this for you, I'm doing it for no one else but you. And it's to do it mindfully. So whatever you want to do it mindfully, to do it with the intention of soothing yourself, of helping yourself through something difficult, of attending to your emotions, of regulating your emotions, and seeing yourself through a hard time and making it better. That's self-care. And failing that, have a glass of wine. No. So yes, mostly I want you to do things that are healthy and constructive. Obviously, having a glass of wine is fine. We all know that's fine, everything in moderation. But, you know, we all know that there's crutches we use that are, we can call it self-care, but really it's just unhealthy. Having a glass of wine is not that. Having too much wine and feeling shit about yourself, that is not great. Anyway, that's me for today. I hope you enjoyed this episode and I would love to hear from you. So hit me up. And I think it's about time to start telling you to subscribe to my podcast. I mean, I haven't done that yet. So if you've been liking what you've been hearing, if you want to hear more, subscribe and stay tuned. There'll be more episodes coming up. And yeah, let me know if you have any thoughts about this episode or future episodes. I'd love to hear from you. So hit me up at On The Couch With Carly. Thank you and goodbye. This podcast is recorded at Edible Audio in Cape Town, South Africa. Edited by Edible Audio. Original music by Alex Smiley.